Thank you for joining us at the OT Corner with Mrs. K. Please note this podcast does not intend to offer medical advice or therapeutic treatment for any medical condition for either yourself or others. If you have any medical or rehabilitation concerns for yourself or your child, please contact your physician. Now, on with the show. Welcome to the OT Corner with Mrs. K., a school-based occupational therapist bringing you a series of interviews and information on childhood development for kids with all different abilities. So get ready, get set, let's go.
Hi, this is Mrs. K from the OT Corner, and today I have a very special guest, Dr. Kate Arth, who is a physical therapist practicing school-based therapy in Ohio. And she is a coworker and friend of mine. She is the physical and occupational therapy team coordinator in our district and serves children with multiple and developmental disabilities from the ages of 3 years all the way up to 22 years old. Kate has a Bachelor of Arts degree in Communication Studies from Bowling Green State University, and she received her Doctor of Physical Therapy degree from Walsh University. And there she received the Clinical Excellence in Peer Recognition Awards. Her research is in the area of collaborative practice and interprofessional education, and she is the lead author of Physical Therapist Student Outcomes of Interprofessional Education in Professional Entry-Level Physical Therapist Education Programs, a systematic review. She is the proud mom of Alex, who is 8 years old and enjoys being active outdoors, reading, traveling, and coaching youth soccer in her community. Please welcome Dr. Kate Arth to the OT Corner. Hi, Kate. Thanks for coming on the OT Corner with Mrs. K today. How you doing?
I'm great. Thank you. How are you?
Good, good, good. So we are just finishing up our holiday break. We have to go back to work next week. But Kate and I, as I mentioned before, work very closely in the preschool and the school district that we work in together. And today we're going to be talking about, Kate and I do a lot of co-treating together. She's a physical therapist and I'm an occupational therapist. And a lot of what we do goes hand in hand. But Kate did a little bit of digging around leading up to this talk today. And what did you find, Kate, about PT and OT? We're just talking about co-treating, that how we co-treat together. But did you find anything, like, research-wise, the benefits?
There is not a lot of research about the benefits of co-treating physical and occupational therapy in the pediatric setting. There is quite a bit of research coming out in, like, neurological rehab for adults. But there is a lot of push in early intervention and early childhood education in terms of multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, and transdisciplinary approaches to childhood development and team collaboration. So basically looking at how service providers and educational providers work together to provide services and co-treatment between service providers, PT, OT, and speech is one of those service delivery models or vehicles that people like to use in order to basically affect the outcomes of students working on those goals together. When you look across different outpatient pediatric practices, there's a lot of practices that use co-treatment between professions as a way of a service delivery. But again, the research in the area is pretty limited, as it's hard to do studies in pediatrics in general, I think. But there's a lot of anecdotal evidence to support the use of collaborative practices and co-treatments in pediatric practice.
And that's basically what we have. We have more anecdotal, like, type outcomes. And we have noticed, Kate and I have, we have the same room that we work in together, and we have a lot of the kids on the same, a lot of the kids are on both of our caseloads. So we'll bring them down together and
some of the things that we've seen, Kate, have been, so Kate will be working on, and Kate, I did an episode on handwriting and all the foundational skills that are involved in handwriting. And one of the big things is the gross motor part. People don't think of that as something that you need for handwriting. That's not the first thing that pops into their mind. What are some of the, let's go into some of the things that we've seen, like what we do with the kids to lay down those foundational skills, especially the gross motor part. How do you come in and how that benefits me?
So I think what's important to note is that instead of just simply sharing data and progress, we use skills and information from both of our disciplines, and we use them in a coordinated fashion to enhance the outcomes of our students. So for example, if Jennifer is working on handwriting and forming basic shapes or lines, then I might have the student in a more stable position to perform that. Or we do a lot of work on the student's stomach, reaching outside of their base of support to develop their postural endurance. In order to have stability, you have to have proximal stability, so stability of your joints and muscles close to your body before you can refine those smaller muscle movements of your hands. If you don't have the stabilization of your core, then Jennifer and I work together in giving students different ways in which to support their body to perform those fine motor movements in the classroom. So developing that proximal and postural stability. We may do short to tall kneeling, so they're working on strengthening and core stability while performing a fine motor task. And each of us grade those tasks for the student as we're working, just to give them that just right challenge in both areas. And then what we find is as we develop those skills together, the students are better able to perform those tasks simultaneously, much faster than if we're working on them independently. Sometimes if we work on them, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I think too, with this age group, what's important to bring up is the different positions are super important, because a kiddo at 3, 4, and 5 years old are not going to be sitting, they're not sitting at a desk at a lengthier time, you know, a long period of time, like an older student might do. So getting them in and out of these different positions is really great for their development. Not only stabilizing, but transitioning to and from a different position as well, which is really important.
And what we seem to find is that a lot of these students, unfortunately, can't move between these positions by themselves. So facilitating those movements and setting up the environment to kind of promote those movements really helps them and guides them in a safe and secure environment to practice them. And then we can grade the level of assistance we're providing as they develop as well.
What we have found working together is that our kids have a quicker progression of these skills. I think they gain confidence quicker. And like you said, when it's done in a safe environment with the support of the therapist there, those skills translate nicely into the classroom. And we see them doing some, you know, being able to sit in the chair a little bit longer, with less supports. I also think that in the past, not only have we co-treated one student together, but we've also done group co-treatments where we filter them through different stations. And not only does the co-treatment of us help, you know, like what we're trying to get out, we have like maybe a gross motor station and a fine motor station, and they're in different positions in each station. But I think what's really neat is that the kids root each other on, they're enjoying it, they're having a good time. And really at this age, that's really how you engage these kiddos. Don't you agree, Kate?
I agree. And I think we talk a lot about push-in therapy, and there's a lot of research and evidence around pushing in and having peer models to support the development of our students. But what we find is some of our students developmentally are so much lower than their peers that they often don't participate as well. when we pull them into a group, what we notice is that children that have a variety of different needs and are at different levels in certain things, but lower overall, they end up being peer models for each other, and they find some success. So we've had a lot of success with movement imitation in a group where we use peer models that may have just slightly higher motor skills than another student versus just doing push-in therapy in the classroom where those peer models might be significantly higher developmentally. And so the strategies that they use aren't necessarily translated to some of our students that have profound needs.
Yeah, it's really neat. And they have a good time. They don't want to leave. They don't want to leave us when we have a group session like that. It's a lot of fun for them. So some of the things that we've been doing in treatment lately. So I think this is a really cool. So I work a lot on visual motor integration. That means using your eyes and your hands together to, copying block formations is a good example, or, threading beads onto a string and, working in that small, a lot of times developmentally, you want to go from large movements to small movements. And that goes also for drawing, pre-writing shapes and, going from big to smaller. So we had a huge delivery of fun chairs that Kate ordered for our district. And we have, I don't know, how many chairs did you order, Kate?
16.
So we have 16 of these beautiful cube boxes. They're huge. So Kate had the wonderful idea of laminating them, putting coverings on, make them a little more aesthetically pleasing to the eye. And now what we do is, so Kate gets the gross motor part in with, we use those for block formations. We play with them. We make forts out of them. We copy different block formations and a larger scale. What are some of the other things we've done this past year? We've changed some things up, which is kind of neat.
We have our cutting box, which was a wonderful idea that came out of the Ready Body Learning Minds curriculum. Mm-hmm. And a cutting box is just a large box that you have a student sit in and play in, and they can cut. We have them draw on the side of the box. We have them climb in and out of the box. And the kids love it because they think they're in a boat. So this year we have a little slide. They climb up the slide, they go in the box, they perform a fine motor activity. Might be threading beads, or it could be just cutting strips of paper or coloring. And then we have them climb out of the box and maybe retrieve a marker or something else for their activity, and then go back down the slide again and do it all over. So we get fine and gross motor, but we also have it incorporated into play. And we use the box to give a defined space, but also provide some postural support for the student while they're performing those fine motor tasks.
And the nice thing about that cutting box is they can wedge themselves into a corner with their little scissors, and it gives their whole body some stabilization because they get to hold the paper with the one arm and it's stabilized by the side of the box. The other hand is holding the scissors, and then they can snip and cut. And scissor skills are hard because they require a lot of strength in the hand. So while you're trying to hold your body up against gravity and all this jazz, you're still trying to like squeeze those scissors, and it's kind of hard. So it's ended up being a lot of fun. We've also turned that into a sensory box too, didn't we?
Yep. We added a whole variety of different things, took their shoes off and socks off and used for hands and feet. And we have a sensory table as well, so the kids could move from floor to stand, pick up items with tweezers or with their fingers, and move to the sensory table and use those items to put in a defined space or match a color or a shape. And so facilitating some of those things that we want using our environment, our tools that we have available, and then incorporating that fine and visual motor together with gross motor in order to achieve outcomes.
So Kate, from a PT perspective, what are some of the main issues that aside, you know, I know that what you do really does help me, but when you are looking at a kid at this age, what are you looking at? What do you want them to be able to do? And what are some of your main focuses in your treatment plans?
So a lot of my focus for the students that we work with is basically developing their foundational motor skills and their foundational sensory motor skills. So they're able to access their environment safely. And so they're able to participate and play and keep up with their peers. So a lot of students that we have come to us and they're able to sit on the floor and stand up and walk, but they're not able maybe to climb the stairs efficiently or access playground equipment or move through in their environment without tripping or falling. Some of them have decreased balance, decreased coordination. And some of those things, when Jennifer and I work together, Jennifer likes to use the sensory processing measure often in her assessments. And what we find is that some of the students that we share have very similar threads in terms of balance in motion, body and space awareness, and vestibular and proprioceptive sensory needs. So basically, if you think of development instead of a pyramid, if you start thinking about it in a circular motion, one thing builds upon the other. So it's very important at this stage to get a variety of sensory motor experiences. Some of our students aren't able to seek those out for themselves. So teaching them those strategies to seek those movements or give themselves the input that they need is really important. But if they don't have the gross motor skills to perform those movements, then they're not able to get their sensory needs met independently. So you might start seeing different behaviors, or you might start seeing a lot of different seeking opportunities or lack of seeking opportunities. So under responsiveness, which impacts their education and the way they seek out experiences within their environment. So my treatment plans always incorporate a lot of postural and core strengthening because a lot of our students lack postural stability. It involves a lot of vestibular movements. So teaching students how to roll and spin themselves. It includes generally a lot of proprioceptive input, and whether that input is something like crashing or that input is simply something like laying in prone or being in quadruped, things like that, that can give us different information to our joints to tell us where we are. And then a lot of midline crossing. So teaching students how to cross midline. We use a lot of stickers and pom-poms to help students cross midline, which also gives them some tactile input, requires some visual motor and some fine motor skills to pull those stickers off. And then I also focus on some balance. So a lot of obstacle courses, changing up the environment, and then generalizing those skills, whether that's within our environment, continuously switching the activities up slightly every week so that they have different experiences, or whether it's across the environment. So out on the playground, within the classroom, and helping them translate those things to the environments that they're in. Typically children are able to explore their environments independently, and the way that they explore those environments and the way that they learn is by seeking out opportunities. A lot of our students with disabilities rely a lot on placement close to them in the environment of activities, or people actually bringing activities to them. So when they rely on those things, those are the only learning opportunities and experiences that those children have, are the things that adults or other children bring to them. So Jennifer and I work a lot on teaching the students how to independently seek out and explore those opportunities, and making those opportunities safe for the student, both in a sensory way. So that helping them experience tactile input in a way that helps them self-regulate versus increases their distress. And then also safely by navigating and moving through that environment to access those opportunities.
I agree. And the thing that I think this is why we always, that sensory processing measure is a standardized assessment that I usually will give either the teacher or the parent, sometimes both. And they'll fill out, because sometimes the sensory reactions are different in different environments. And a lot of times when we give that standardized assessment, you'll see very different answers coming from the parents, and everybody's like, why is this? Well, it might just be the environment. When you are in a school environment and you're not, you know, especially at this age, this is your first experience with school, and the lights are bright and the noises are different, the smells are different. All this stuff really does affect a kid, and either it sends them into a bout of disorganization, and you'll see them running around and their behavior is completely different than if they were at home, or they withdraw and they don't want to experience anything, then they might be in distress. So the sensory, you know, part really, I think, in this age group is important. I think even kids without disabilities have these issues. So, letting them have those experiences in different environments is very important, especially in the school setting. It allows them to engage and explore and be safe, like you said, be safe if they get too overstimulated. And then once Kate's like established this gross, you know, motor, this laying those foundational skills for gross motor skills, a lot of times what I'll do is like, well, you know, Kate wants them to reciprocate up and down steps. So we'll have them, we have these huge flight of steps in our school. We'll have them go all the way up to the window, do something fine motor at the window, and then come all the way back down. So really mixing it up, because in real life, that's what happens. You do stuff, you don't, skills aren't practiced in isolation all the time. They're usually layered. And it's really important to start working on that at an early age. Kate and I I wanted to bring this up too. I think this is really important, this age group, especially with communication, because at this age, kids are having a more difficult time communicating, and we see behaviors. And a lot of the time it's just communication issues. What are some of the things that we use? The visual schedule, right?
We use the visual schedule so that the students know that there's a clearly defined beginning and ending, what to expect next, and how to follow a routine. We also use a lot of music and singing. We have songs for everything, a lot of them that we've made up.
They expect those songs too.
They expect those songs, and they participate in singing them eventually. And then a lot of routines. So we know the first thing that we do when we go into the room is wash our hands. Then the next thing that we do is check our schedule. And then we take a look at the schedule. And then when we finish the activity, the item goes in a defined space in a box. And then we take a look at our schedule until it's time to walk back to class. And then when it's time to walk back to class, it's also very structured. It comes with a lot of singing again to help those students regulate in the hallways, follow a routine, have some like rhythmic pace of movement and some safe movement exploration while they move through their environment. And they do a really good job with those things. What we find is when we don't use those things, a lot of our students become a little more dysregulated, a little bit harder to stay on track. Some of them have a hard time following the schedule and participating initially, but I think a lot of our students also have a fear of the unknown and without knowing what their expectations are. So once we establish the routine and the schedule, they have an easier time coming into the room, self-regulating, and then participating in their work because they know what the expectation is.
Visual schedules and songs are so important, I think, especially at this age. I mean, and when you get older, you're not singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and they'll like to a fifth grader, but you know, it really does, though. They, like I said, at this age group, 3 to 5 years old, they don't get the beginning and ending concept unless there's a clear structured setup. And it really does help, and it decreases behaviors significantly. And we still get them. I think, you know, you don't know what's going on with the kid when they come into the school that day. They might not be feeling well, but generally it does overall help. And then I just wanted to do like one last like co-treatment session, what it would look like. Let's like a typical, like I will pick like a kid that has, who's on the spectrum, may not be verbal, doesn't, you know, walking down the hallway looks fine, but when you actually put some demands on them, it's tough. So what would a session like that look like, Kate? You want to start that?
Yeah, sure. So I think the first thing we would do is transition, and we always transition with a song, and we always transition in a static environment to start. And really a lot of times it's so that the student can get oriented in that static position. So we follow the motor learning continuum with having that static environment. And we transition with a song. Our fun game that we do right now is fast and slow. So practicing moving in different speeds and listening to the verbal command and taking those visual cues from the therapists on when to move faster and when to move slower. Then we get to our therapy door and we have our visual schedule right there. And we always ask them, what's the first thing we do? We wash our hands. We go to the sink where we have a little step, so they already get some gross motor in there while they're washing their hands with stepping up and then some balance, stepping on a stool while they wash their hands. And that can be hand over hand, that could be faded assistance, however much assistance the student needs. In front of them, we have the visual schedule for washing their hands, and we also have some songs for each step of the process, so the student can learn what to expect coming next. And then the student dries their hands, and usually we hide the trash can from them, so they have to visually scan the room and locate the trash can, mm-hmm. to throw out their paper towel. And then we have them check their schedule. And usually what we do is we do a fine motor task and then a gross motor task and a fine motor task and a gross motor task. And usually either the fine or gross motor task has the opposite component in it. It's just that the primary task would be fine or gross motor. So for example, we might go to the cutting box where the primary task is going to be to cut along a line. But the gross motor component will be accessing the box and maintaining the postural control in the box while we perform the cutting task. Then we might move to ball skills, and we might get out of the box to perform the ball skills, where the primary task is going to be that gross motor component of throwing and catching. But the fine motor or sensory motor or visual motor component may be setting up cups to knock down after we throw a ball, or it can be throwing to different colors or targets, or visually scanning to locate items, or we use different types of sensory balls. So balls with spikes and balls that are squishy and balls that are huge and claps with little fuzzy things on the end of them to help with that tactile input. And we have different types of weighted balls so that some are light, some are heavy, to give different sensory input. When we complete that task, then we may move to another fine motor specific task, which let's say is drawing or writing on a board. So we use the vertical surface so that we can create that shoulder stability. But the gross motor component of that might be postural stability. So we could be in tall kneeling, short kneeling, half kneeling. We might be in prone working at a vertical board to facilitate some of that extension and work on those extensor muscles. We find that a lot of kids don't enjoy laying on their bellies when we start, but nope. We find in a year or two, they choose that posture when they're working in the classroom. So it's kind of cool to see. From that activity, we might move to the stairs or some type of steps. So right now, our favorite thing is we have a little set of steps in our room, and the kids we have right now, a lot of them love the alphabet.
yes, so letters are big.
we muddle up the alphabet magnets on the board, or the number magnets on the board, and the students may have to go down and collect a magnet, go up the steps and put it on the board, or they might have to locate a magnet while they're balancing on a single step. And so we're working on that visual motor component, that fine motor component with grasping and picking up items, and then that gross motor component with climbing the steps and that postural stability and balance while working at a vertical surface. And then,
which I love, those are my favorite. You can't have too many easels in the house.
And then we will leave the classroom, and we may use a tricycle to go back to the room. We might use a scooter, or we might walk. And when we walk, we like to sing songs like "The Ants Are Marching," and have students imitate movements with us. And, they also get that repetitive beat of music and it helps them maintain their pace. And then they understand what the expectation is. So we get imitation, listening, and then that rhythmic incorporation of that rhythm to help them pace their movements and have some body control. So that's kind of what one of our sessions might look like.
And there's so many pretty things on the walls. We have some very creative preschool teachers where we work. And the temptation is to reach out and touch whatever's on the wall. So sometimes we'll put like a heavy ball in their arms or have them carry something that not only grounds them and centers their body, but also allows the hands to stay on something other than the wall. We do a lot of that stuff, make so they're not. I had to repair a couple of things in the hallway this past fall, but that's what a session looks like. And I have to say, just personally, if I say Kate and I are not we co-treat, I would say 90% of the time in preschool, We do have some kiddos that are not on each other's caseload, or sometimes we're not, one of us is not there. I use a lot of those gross motor techniques that Kate uses in my treatments. So sometimes, you know, teachers will be walking by and I'll be by myself as an OT, and they'll see me like, you know, with the kid on the slide and probably figuring out why is this OT, but really it does. Those are the foundationals. The foundational skills are super, super important. And, you know, I will use those gross motor skills interchangeably when I'm just by myself with the kid.
And same thing with me. I use the fine motor skills, but I think the cool thing is we have some overlapping disciplines, but development doesn't happen in a silo. So I use the fine motor components that Jennifer uses, but I use the Jennifer's model and knowledge to understand what that student is capable of. So I might think a student isn't able to do something gross motor wise, like they're not able to sit in a chair. So I'm working on that with a fine motor task, but if I don't look at how difficult that fine motor task is for them to perform, I might not be understanding the full picture of the child and might think that issue is postural, where it might be a fine motor issue and they need to modify that task for the student. So I think, you know, developmentally, this is what typical children are doing. They're moving through their environment, they're playing, they're interacting, they're giving themselves input, they're picking things up, they're coloring, they're bringing things to their mouths. They're reaching across midline, they're rolling, they're turning, but our students aren't doing all these things, or they might be doing them in isolation. And so we kind of help facilitate those things together, but at that just right level where it's just challenging enough for them. But if it's just enough challenging gross motor and just enough challenging fine motor wise, then we get an increase in development in both areas and work cohesively towards those developmental goals, because they go hand in hand.
Well, Kate, thanks so much for coming today. I really, thanks really appreciate it. Me. And now Kate and I have also worked with older children too. Right now we primarily just work in the preschool together, but Kate, I'd love to have you back and we can talk about some of the things that we've done with some of our older students as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
That'd be great. Okay.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the OT Corner with Mrs. K. Feel free to join the OT Corner community by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. If you have a topic you want to hear about, or if you would like to come on the show, feel free to contact Jennifer at theotcorner.com. We would love to hear from you. All information from the show is listed in the episode notes. We know you can listen to anyone, so we appreciate you stopping by. Until next time, thanks again.